Yes.
All right.
I'm just going to explain to you why we're doing this, the purpose, and why you're here today. This is kind of like our video archive, like project that we interview. We interview certain people about their childhood and the trials and tribulations they went through as far as integration and all of that. Now, you're a bit younger, so...
Well, thank you for saying that.
Well, you're younger than most of our guests.
Sure?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That one guy who's...
I see some guy with my...
Hello, sir.
Good afternoon.
My name is Kimmel Pierre-Lewis, and this is our co-interviewer, Tiffany Timbers.
How are you?
How are you?
And I am at William H. Turner Technical Art School to interview...
Ricky Wiggins.
And we're here to talk about your personal history.
All right.
Good afternoon, Mr. Wiggins.
Good afternoon, ma'am.
Can you please describe when and where you were born and a bit about your parents and grandparents?
Okay. I was born in Hollywood, Florida, just in Broward County. My parents were James and Lucille Wiggins. I had four other sisters and then an extended family membership because in our house we had four other people that lived with us. And in that particular experience, it was quite interesting because we lived in a two-bedroom apartment. Mm-hmm. And there were, I don't know, 11 of us that stayed there. And the street I lived on was remarkably beautiful because most people who had major challenges economically and otherwise never believed and never acted as if they were poor. Mm-hmm. We all seemed to work together as a community, especially through the street that we were on. And we pulled for each other. We made sure that everyone collectively got the best that life would offer us and did the best that we could under those circumstances. In terms of my upbringing with my parents, my father was a construction worker. My mother did what was called day's work. She was a domestic worker. She worked in a hotel on Miami Beach at the Olympia Hotel, right on the water. Beautiful, beautiful hotel as a maid. And periodically, my sister and I would get the chance to go to work with her as we were growing up. And it was always a thrill to leave the neighborhood because that was not always a regular occurrence for us. We were pretty much relegated to where we lived. And it was a rarity for us to go many places, unlike what young people today probably experience at a great deal of ease. Being mobile was something not necessarily indigenous to my upbringing. Although we did have a car, my father had to use the car to go to work. And my father worked very early in the morning and into the late parts of the evening, almost 7 days a week. And so our family didn't necessarily get the privilege of having many outings of pleasure, if you will, for the exception of going to church and to, of course, going to school. And in my neighborhood, of course, during that period, we're talking about the 60s. I was born in 1960, and so I'm 46 years old, and I celebrated my 46th birthday on February 15th, a few weeks ago. In my neighborhood, everything was black. All the police officers were black. All the vendors and entrepreneurs in my neighborhood were black. At my school, all my teachers were black. My principal was black. The truant officer, I'm sure you guys don't even know about that kind of person in that role, but he was the guy who went after people who didn't go to school or didn't get to school on time. He was black. The local little juke joints and hangout places that my parents went to was all black. And there was one particular club in my neighborhood called the Palms where the great entertainers of that era permeated and entertained before they would actually go over to Miami Beach where my mom worked to entertain white audiences. That was another black experience. There were people like James Brown, Jackie Wilson, Diana Ross and the Supremes, the Temptations, Aretha Franklin, those type people I was very much aware of as a child because, for the most part, my parents saw them. They came to that particular club, the Palms, on a regular basis. And we had the great privilege one time, I was a real young child, and I don't remember it, but they tell me about it, where James Brown actually came to our house, which was a huge deal. My mama got a chance to cook for him, and he had a backup group or a contributing group called the Flames. It was James Brown and the famous Flames. They were like the dancing guys behind him, and they did the little woohoo type sounds, whatever, when James was singing, which was cool. And so my neighborhood was filled with different experiences. Those things I just described to you were very positive, and yet there was a negative side, too. It seemed that during that time, there were people who were involved in a lot of illicit activity as well, drugs and prostitution, the selling of stolen goods and that kind of thing. That existed, too. And yet, there seemed to have been a code in my neighborhood. The code was that when it was time to go to church on Sunday, all the foolishness ceased. And that meant that if you were about something that wasn't right or wasn't good, you just couldn't be about that in the public. You had to go somewhere or be somewhere in a private setting where only you and those folks who were looking to indulge in that activity would do those things, but not necessarily in the public. And so as a boy, I saw a varied kind of experience and learned things very quickly about myself and about the world. Spent a lot of time watching television, although there were three channels. I know that's hard for you all to believe. There was Channel 4, Channel 7, and Channel 10. And that was it. No such thing as cable. The radio, there were only about four or five stations. There was only one black station during that time where I heard black voices and knew about black issues. And there were very few reading or informational outlets that we had during that period. The biggest was Jet Magazine and Ebony Magazine. And that's where I learned more about my own heritage and my own history through those two mediums, in the print medium at least. And there were very few things in the electronic medium about black people and what they were doing. And yet Jet in particular, or Ebony in particular, I'm sorry, would show another side of black people who were doing so many things that were upwardly mobile. They showed people who were in college and who were achievers, people who were about serious businesses, people who were internationally involved. And those things really jumped out at me as a very young boy because I wanted to experience that for myself. And in spite of my own situation at home with all those folks in my house, I kept dreaming. I wanted to be them being somebody who I never touched hands with. I wanted to be a part of the larger world, the larger society, if you will. In that period, there were certain things that happened with certain individuals that I remember. When I was 8 years old, Martin Luther King was killed. He was assassinated in April. I think it was April 4th, if I remember, at the Lorraine Hotel in Memphis. And I remember as a boy, on the day that Martin Luther King was killed, how gloomy the day was. The weather was kind of strange looking. It looked like it was going to rain, but it never rained. It was just ugly outside. And I remember how my parents responded to his death. I didn't know much about Martin Luther King at 8 years old, but I remember how my parents looked. They were so despondent and they were so hurt. It was one of the few times I saw my father, who was a very a large man. My father was about 6'4", 6'5", about 245 pounds, like Jim Brown, if you remember Jim Brown, the football player. My father was about that size. My father was a rough-looking kind of guy. He had an exterior, too, that made you think that he was impervious to pain, that nothing really bothered him. And yet, on the day that we recognized that Dr. King was killed, I saw my father cry. That was a significant day to me because I knew that something important had happened, that it would strike my father like that. And therefore, I wanted to know more about what Dr. King was about and what he stood for. And as I did do that particular process, I found out about things like Mahatma Gandhi and his whole idea about peace and the idea of nonviolence and the idea and the issue of inclusion and recognizing people of different races and cultures, and the importance that it would be, and it would be from time forward, that people, regardless of their backgrounds, they would get together and embrace their differences, but also embrace where they were the same. It was very important for me to see and understand that, because as I grew up, I saw a lot of issues and areas that were so racist and so ugly and so detrimental to so many people. And I know you have other questions, but I had too much to say about that one. Sorry. But I just have to tell you that it was difficult for people during that time to get over that little hump, or that big hump, if you will, as it pertained to people and differences. There were many issues and circumstances that I saw people struggle educationally, socially, and otherwise because of matters of race. And they were quite difficult for an 8-year-old boy growing up trying to figure out who he was to deal with those things. And so I'll stop there and let you ask another question.
Well, I'm sorry. What school did you go to?
Okay. I went to Chester A. Moore Elementary School. While at Chester A. Moore, it was the advent of what you all might know now as programs for kids who were emotionally challenged, or EH-type programs. I was one of those kids. And I was deemed challenged, if you will, because I was taught, and it was drilled into me so strongly, that I could not speak, or I should not speak, unless someone speaks to me first, being an adult. So I only spoke when someone spoke to me. If an adult said something to me, then, and they gave me the opportunity to return that, then I did it. If not, I kept my mouth closed. So I think people who looked at me thought something was wrong with me. You know, this kid never says a word. It was just about being a part of the decorum that was set for me through my parents about speak only when you're spoken to, keep your mouth shut, don't say nothing, honor your elders, be sure to do exactly what you're told to the letter. And in other words, it was very rigid, very, very to the point. And there was no, like, flexibility there. You had to be like that. And for me, I took it to the nth degree about that. And so therefore, I don't think it had anything to do with my academic abilities. I think it was more so just about me honoring what my parents said. And because that program itself was very new, unfortunately, I was placed in a program where there were other kids who did have real issues, real challenges, psychologically and otherwise. And I was in some classes kind of said those type of things about me, and I was never bothered by it. I didn't really care. I recognized that the school thought it was the best thing for me, and therefore my parents thought so, and I went along with that. And so when we were in class, teacher asked me to read, I would read. She asked me to do something else, I'd do that. And finally, the day comes and I get around fourth grade, and this teacher comes up and says, "I want to test you." And I said, "Okay, yes, ma'am," right? And in the test, she found that I read on the seventh grade level. And I was, you know, fourth grade. She said, "Oh, you can read." I said, "Yes, ma'am." She said, "I want you to write me a story. Just pick out a story you want to write." And I remember asking the question, "On anything?" She said, "Just make up a story for me." And I wrote about a boy flying on a balloon and seeing the world. And the story wound up being about 2 or 3 pages. And at the end of the story, the boy gets a chance through that odyssey of meeting all types of people who were different than him. Of course, some who were just like him, but people of other groups. And she looked at me, she asked me the question, she said, "Why are you here?" And I said, "I don't know." And I remember that was the first day that my life was about to change, because this woman, her name was Mrs. Woodard at the time, she went to the principal and said that I had been misdiagnosed and that I should have been in regular classes, whatever that meant during that period. Mm-hmm. And from there, C.A. Moore to Lanier Middle School, and the middle school experience was much like yours, because it was a time, this happened to be in the 70s at that point, where integration was happening. Integration was a very, very strange and a weird experience for me, because unlike other locations in Broward County where there was busing, the big issue was busing. Are you familiar with the Supreme Court decision, Brown versus the Board of Education?
Yes.
All right, you know about all that whole thing about separate but equal and trying to integrate schools. All right, good. In Florida, there were things, in some instances, that were very slow about that. Although the law became the law, it didn't mean that it was being carried out right away. Ultimately, though, it did get to where I lived and the community that I lived in and the county I lived in. And so in Broward County, the big issue was busing black children into white schools. They thought that was going to be the way to make the situation in terms of education equal, which was, in my opinion, a mistake. But nevertheless, that's what the attempt was. And so every day on the news, you would see these incredible fights and these makeshift fences that kept the black kids on one side and the white kids on the other side. And they were at each other, fighting and throwing rocks and chains, people rocking buses, and it was very ugly. A lot of people got hurt. And yet, in my neighborhood, for whatever reason, and this happened to be, I guess I was 11, 12, my neighbor had the high school that was the only high school that bused white kids into a black neighborhood in Broward County. And so I always wondered about why was that? And I still don't know the answer to that fully, but I recognized the reality, and I remember embracing the idea of white kids coming to school with us. And I remember the other black kids that I knew very well, on the first week or so of these white students coming into what we thought was our school, right? It was no longer just the school, it was our school now. And these white kids coming in, and I remember how scared they were. They were horrified. First of all, just to take the ride from where they were coming from, because they came from an area in Hollywood, and I'm in Hallandale. It's only like a couple of mile difference, but it's a whole other world when you consider the realities of Hollywood and a place called Emerald Hills. It's almost like the Wizard of Oz, right? It was called Emerald City and the Wizard of Oz. Okay. They came from a place that was just opulent and beautiful, big homes, and they had people that worked inside their houses and cleaned up their house. Like my mom did on the beach, they had many people like that, and most of them had that kind of experience. Then we also had another group of white kids who came from an area called Lake Forest. And in Lake Forest, there were poor white children that came to our school, and they were as poor or worse than the majority of the black kids that went to the same school as I did. And so that mixture was very interesting, because you had these real rich white kids, these poor or to middle class black kids, and then these very, very poor pockets of white kids that came to the same high school. And in those first few weeks, although there was very little fighting, there was just this tension. And I remember in classes where there was the obvious mixture of students, the teachers were also on edge as well, because they wanted to make sure that at some point the kids would embrace each other or just engage each other in conversation about who they were. And there were different assignments that they were given by, the school board to try to carry out. And I remember making friends. One of the first friends I met was a guy named Michael Moses, who happened to be Arab from a descent standpoint. But Mike Moses was one of the best athletes I'd ever seen. He could play everything, and I was good too, you know, at that time in the sports experience. And so we competed in PE. And while in PE, because Mike was so good and because I knew I was good, he and I, we hit it off. And because other people watched us, we wound up being catalysts for our school. He and I became the greatest friends. We ate lunch together. We sat by each other, which was huge, because what you would have in the cafeteria, and some of you still are dealing with that now at this school. I know this is true. You got a black section, or just black kids, period, sitting in one section. You got white kids or Hispanic kids now sitting in another section. You know, that's just real. Because we only dealt with two groups at that point, because there were very few, if any, Hispanic kids at all that were around. The only person I knew that spoke Spanish was Johnny the Ice Cream Man. And I thought that was so cool that he spoke like he did. I said, man, what you saying? And he taught me some words in Spanish, which was cool. You know, he was great. Everybody loved Johnny. He just, like, why did Johnny talk so funny? I don't know, but that, I guess it's cool. Give me some ice cream. that whole separation thing kept itself up, but it was out of fear and ignorance. Not ignorance in the sense that people were indifferent. They just didn't know. And fear kind of pervaded the situation. It just kind of got in there. But Mike Moses and I, we kind of broke a barrier, I guess, as I think about it now. Because Mike and I, we would joke about things. I would go to his house, which was like totally unheard of. And he said, man, come over to my house, meet my dad. His dad was the athletic director at Chaminade High School, James Moses. And I would go to their house, and I couldn't, they had a pool, right? Which was like, that blew my mind. I was like, damn, pool. And I couldn't even swim, right? But I got in the pool anyway. I stayed in the shallow part. And, you know, sat around and ate and talked about a lot of different things. And we were just so familiar and such great friends that we were an example for so many other people who were just not sure. And then Mike would come to my house, and my mother would cook for him. My father, who was a little different, he wasn't necessarily too warm to that idea of Mike being in my house, I'm being honest with you. And yet, he would accept him enough that he, well, you're in my house again, you may as well just bring your ass on in here. You know, come on in. But that was a great lesson for me in terms of my relationship with Mike, because it made me understand that there were people who, although they looked different than me, and although they had certain, at that time, certain obvious advantages that I did not have in life, that I was still dealing with other human beings. And that taught me a lot of things about tolerance. It taught me a lot of things about being able to see myself through challenge and circumstance. It taught me also about being courageous enough to recognize that there were things I wanted to do and I wanted to be that were going to be good in spite of all my other circumstances. So from there, went on to experience in high school, which was was totally different, because high school was, you know, we passed that period in America where it was not so unusual for different races to mix with each other. There was this program called American Bandstand. It was a dance show. And the guy that he's been doing it now for years, but he's been ill. I can't think of his name right now.
Dick Clark.
Right. He used to host when the ball comes down for the new year. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh. And he had American Bandstand. American Bandstand was so cool, where he would bring on the coolest groups or singers. And they were the hottest thing happening at that moment. And if you made an American Bandstand, you were like the thing, you know. And that's where you saw black kids and white kids dance. Mm-hmm. And that was incredible. To see the mixing going on. And then things got really awesome when, during that same period, Don Cornelius and some others got together, and they came up with what was called Soul Train. Mm-hmm. Now, Soul Train to me was incredible, because it was at a time where, being in high school, it was still important to black kids, especially black males, to assert themselves, because you had no other opportunities to do such a thing. Whereas white boys and white girls always had the opportunity to be rebels to whatever degree, to be hippies or whatever that was. Black kids didn't have an opportunity to necessarily express themselves like that. And yet Soul Train was an integral part of the experience, because you saw the freedom in the dance thing. You saw the expression of being just black and being strong and being vibrant and being intelligent and watching people articulate the language and your colloquial language or the neighborhood language and giving legitimacy to that. Those things were very important to me. That someone would give me that kind of validation that, hey, you know, a lot of stuff you're doing ain't that bad, brother. It's all right. You know, you can be you and still do with the rest of the world, and it's good. It's going to still be okay. So that made me feel very strong. And yet I also had a longing still for more. And so high school to me was like a flower being that's been planted that's now beginning to bud and to grow up and to grow out. And by the time I got to be like a sophomore in high school and really understood what was happening, I recognized the importance of grades and the fact that my grades were going to be paramount to my success. And so with all that BMOC stuff, oh, you don't know what that is, all right. Big man on campus, your teacher knows what that is. I was one of them, you know. I was a bad boy, right? Okay. And the girls, that the whole thing, all that was important. You know, that was big. It was huge. You know, to socially have a place where people could know who you were just by you showing up. You go in a place and say, oh, there go Rick right there. Mm-hmm. You know, that was awesome, right? And you would use that, or I would use that to my advantage on many occasions. And then because within the school environment, because it became such a big part of my experience, and even socially, I would use that to my advantage a lot of times with a lot of grown people. You know, I see certain teachers and they would say, oh, Ricky Williams, why have you turned your assignment? I said, oh, Miss Williams, I'm sorry, I forgot. Can I turn them off? Of course you can, right? And I would watch them penalize somebody else for the same thing they wouldn't do that to me on. Because I had gotten that kind of rep, you know. But I understood eventually, though, that wasn't so cool. That was like that 10th grade thing, you know, you playing football and basketball, and you have decent grades and you read well and you think you're kind of cool, and the girls told you you were fine and all that kind of thing. You think you got it made, and that wasn't true. That was not true. That was just talk. I had to make the connection. In spite of all the things that were happening with the nation, our country, socially, and I must go back to that. I remember Nixon was president and Watergate came down. That was a horrible time in this country.
Yeah, 1972.
I was 12 years old. It really tore our country apart, the Watergate scandal. And yet, if you read about it and you read intently about it, President Nixon was about to go for re-election, and he was concerned as to whether or not he was going to win. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you all, he shouldn't have had no concern at all. He was going to kill McGovern anyhow. But because of his own craziness, he got other folks involved in a thing that caused him to do some spying, and then it got bigger and bigger and bigger, and ugly things began to happen. And just think, the first tip that something was wrong about that campaign came from a black man who was a custodian at a hotel called the Watergate Hotel. A brother just doing his job, right? And that was the beginnings of all the ugliness that happened with that. And then you had these two reporters from the Washington Post to begin to write about it, and hopefully you know the history from that. But that was important still for me. This black boy living in Hallandale, Florida with, you know, 11 people, whatever it was in the household, with, you know, 2 bedrooms, 1 bathroom, and me sleeping still at that point on the floor with the, you know how you have a sofa and you got the thing you sit on, whatever that is? Mm-hmm. That was my, you know, you took that out and I put it on the floor, and my mother made me a pillow out of just things. That was my bed until I was ready to go to college, and I'll get to that in a minute. But that was how I slept. Didn't bother me. It didn't bother me because I recognized what was really happening. My parents were truly doing the best they could do under the circumstances. And there was no room for me to, like, gripe and, you know, like, complain, like, oh, Mom, or dinner. I need my bed. Man, if I had told my father I needed a bed, he'd have been like I was crazy. Because the beds were already taken with my sisters, and I told you I had two cousins and two uncles that stayed with us periodically, and they were older, and so they got the, whatever that was there for them comfortably. I was like the last on the totem pole to get whatever was left. So it was no need for me to gripe about that. My thing was to do what I was supposed to do as well as I could do it. You know, and in my own little world, my world was at school. Because eventually, with my friendship with Mike Moses, earlier years and then in the high school, I had recognized that if I would grasp the realities of school, I could be whoever I wanted to be. And in spite of all the racial issues that were still going on in the 70s, it was a volatile time all over the world with varying things that took place. Black and white, white and Asian, black and Asian, whatever you want to call it, it was happening. And then the advent of the push that women began to place on this country about being recognized, all of that thing, women's liberation, all those things were going on. And there I was experiencing some of that and trying to retain as much as I could in terms of what the factual things were. I still had to stay in touch with who I was and who I was trying to be. Very powerful period. And music, again, was so important and so validating for me because although I couldn't and didn't have the money to go to a concert, I fell in love with music on the radio. Marvin Gaye was my favorite singer, and it still is my favorite singer of all time. Marvin Gaye in 1972 put out an album called What's Going On. And I'm telling you right now, if you never had the chance to listen to it, if you get the album or the CD, golly, I'm sitting on my albums. You get the CD and just listen to it. You would think that Marvin made the album yesterday, that CD yesterday. And it was about the 70s. He's talking about war and violence. He's talking about the ecology and what we're doing to our earth. You know, global warming and all those things. He's talking about government and social issues. He's talking about the issue of saving the babies, meaning we got to start working on trying to save our children. We got to take care of our kids. That if we don't do that, we're going to lose in this race, the unfortunate race that the humankind has with each other about who's going to be smarter than the next one the next time around. He's thinking about all of those things in the 70s. And if you get that CD, you will know what I'm talking about. He also, of course, he's singing about love. He sang about relationships and family. And so that whole time became very powerful to me. And to sum the rest of that experience up, there came that final year of high school after you have spent 4 years of, quote, unquote, being the man, right? Now, there was no FCAT. You guys are about to do that, some of you, I guess. There was no FCAT during that period, but there was the advent of what became the functional literacy test. And they were using the senior class that year as an experiment to see how they do on that test, but it wasn't going to count. And I remember I got selected to take the test. And when I saw the test, I wasn't intimidated by the test, but I was concerned about what the results would be and how people were going to construe what I do on it. And I had the luxury of refusing to take the test, so I told them no. I wasn't going to take it. And they said, okay, fine. We got somebody else. But there were other kids who took the test, and they did okay. But the whole idea of testing and then getting out of high school was the thing of the day. That was getting ready to come. The following year, my sister, who was a year behind me, and she hated that because obviously, you know, her brother was like I told you, he was the man. And people would say, oh, you're Ricky Williams' little sister. And she said, no, my name is Sherry. But she had to take that test. And she had to deal with all those things. She had to make up skills or do them over. And the reality behind that ultimately was testing became a big part of the experience for young people. If you want to advance, they're going to give you a test. Now, you can feel any way you want to about the FCAT and all that stuff. And I have my own personal views about that. But in some cases, it's not anything new. It's just more. It's going to continue to be more. I think it's very unfortunate that we would use a test the way we're using the FCAT, but that's another conversation. Mm-hmm. I think that if you go to school for 12 years and you've mastered classes enough for you passing them with at least a C, and that you have all of your credits, you should be able to walk across somebody's stage and get your diploma. Mm-hmm. I believe that. I really do. And at the same time, though, I do recognize that there is a connection to testing, because as you go off to college and wherever you go, there will be tests, and they will determine what happens to you as you going forward is concerned. But as far as high school experience, those are my feelings. But let me get to my senior year, and I'm going to be finished with that. We can go on. In my senior year of high school, I didn't know what it was like to do anything different than what everybody else was doing in my neighborhood. In my neighborhood, the biggest thing that you could do was get a job at Winn-Dixie, being a worker. You work at Winn-Dixie, man. My thing was I wanted to be in the produce section and working in that section because they were spraying the little vegetables. You ever see those I wanted to do that. And it was at inside in the air conditioner. I was like, okay, I work inside, man. That's certainly cool to be outside. And they have white jackets on. I thought that was definitely cool, right? White jacket, you spraying little vegetable things, and the pretty little honey's coming in with their mothers, you know, so hey, you're in there. And you're getting paid, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, man, that's what I want to do. I can't really get it. I'm going to win Dick's, give me a job. And I had been an athlete throughout the time, and so my basketball coach said to me, he said, you know, Ricky, you should go to college. I said, man, I don't know about no college. Nobody in my family go to college. He said, no, you could go. I said, how do I do that? He said, you could get a scholarship. I said, what's that? He says, that's when people have money and they pay for you to go to school. I was like, who's going to do that for me? And then I remember him taking me to my counselor. And they looked at my grades and they saw that I had good enough grades to qualify for a lot of different scholarships. And I certainly still didn't make the connection still. I kept thinking, oh yeah, you're kind of smart, but that don't mean nothing. And there I was, 17 years old, about to be 18, and my life was in front of me. And I was balking at the idea of doing exactly what I thought I wanted to do all of my life, which was seeing the rest of the world. I was scared. I kept saying, you know, you're that beautiful story about being on the balloon and you're seeing the world, and now you have a chance to go see the world as a college student, now you're scared. So you just want to be back in the neighborhood doing that cool thing, being with the honeys at Winn-Dixie, and you want to settle for that. I had a big conversation with myself about that. My coach, who was a tough man, he said, no, you're going to take your ass to school. And I said, where will I go? He said, where do you want to go? And I remember looking in the college catalog. You all should already be experiencing that if you're juniors. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was this thing on Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. It looked like it had my name on it. And I wrote out an application and sent it to them, and they accepted me within a week. And I remember they were actually what amounts to recruiting. They were recruiting me to come there. So I flew my first little flight, you know, on a plane to Athens. And it was in the wintertime, and it was so cold. It was snowing. I had never seen snow before. So as I was getting off the plane and looking back out at the snow, I knew I wasn't going to come to school there. I mean, ain't no way in the hell I'm going to be out here in this cold-ass weather. I'm from Florida. And so I got back home and I talked to my counselor. I said, well, are there other schools I can go to where the weather's like where I'm accustomed to? She said, yeah, there are many. She said, why don't you apply to something that's closer to home? And so I was thinking maybe I'll go to a community college, which would have been fine, right? She says, no. You won't be able to get a scholarship at a lot of community colleges because you, although you get some, you could get more if you went to a four-year school. I'm like, okay, what are they? And she's talking about Barry, St. Thomas, which was another name at that time, and the University of Miami. Now, I knew the University of Miami because they had, you know, some popular things going on there athletically. I said, okay, well, maybe I'll apply to the University of Miami. And got the application in, not thinking they would ever accept me. And got accepted. And I was scared because, hey, I really didn't want to go. I was just doing stuff for the grown people, you know. And I got accepted at UM. And so now, here I am, a real moment of truth now because you've been accepted, got the letter. And now I got to go. And I got all the scholarships, financial aid, and stuff like that. And I remember my father and his wisdom. He, who had a very limited education on his own, he worked on a farm most of his life, his young life. And we talked about school. It was about maybe a 30-second conversation. My father said, so this scholarship thing, boy, let me ask you now. You're going to school down there at Carl Gables. I said, yes, sir. He said, they're going to give you a place to stay. I said, yes, sir. He said, every day? I said, yes, sir. He said, you have your own room? I said, yes, I'll be in a room. Yes, sir. There'll be somebody there else there, my roommate. He said, you have a place to put your clothes? I said, yes, sir. He said, what about food? You be able to eat down there? I said, yes, sir. They have something called a meal plan I'm going to be on. He said, you can eat every day. How many times? I said, I think it's 3 times a day. And he said, you don't have to pay for that. I said, no. He said, I don't have to pay for that. I said, yes, sir. And he said, you going to go to school? I said, yes. And then my father looked at me, and he said, boy, let me tell you something. You better go down there and do exactly what those people tell you. He says, you go down there, and you do your absolute best. He says, if it means that you don't even come home for a while, I don't want you to come home. He says, you stay down there. I know it ain't that far. He said, but you stay down there as long as they want you to and do exactly what they say. And if you do that, you'll be all right. He said, we'll call you sometime when we need to call you. And sometimes you can call us. He said, but you stay your ass right down here. And you go to school. And I said, yes, sir. And that was the beginnings of my association with the rest of the world. Because when I got down to the University of Miami in 1978, I guess, when I graduated high school, that's when I met really up close and personal where the rest of the world was. I met students from all over the world. My roommate was from Pakistan on one side. My other roommate was from Uruguay on the other side. I was on the floor with pre-med students, and they were from all over the globe. And yet, in a general sense, on the campus, I met people from, truthfully, every country there was on this planet, just about. I met people from Africa. I met people from all over the Asian continent. I met people from everywhere. And what was so incredible to me was the beauty in every person that I met. And it made me know that we had a chance as a society to do better than what we had done. Not to be so mad and so angry that we couldn't, but that we as young people with our own experience had the chance to make it better. And if there is anything that I want to communicate to all of you today is that by virtue of who you are and what you're doing, you still have that greater chance with what you're doing today to make it even better than what it already is. It is better. Is it great? Absolutely not. Can it be much better? Absolutely. Will it take you guys to do it? Yes, because most of the people who are my age and older are tired, consumed with other stuff that means nothing, and yet you're fresh. You have the energy to make it happen. And so I hope I've met some of your questions. If there are other questions, I'll go ahead and do that. But
what was it that you were studying at the University of
Miami? Oh, okay. I was an industrial psychology major, which guided the intricacies of the business world, because I was a double major in business and in psychology. And that was an interesting experience as well, because I got a chance to learn a lot more about how companies worked and how workers worked and how to make things better for people as they worked.
Okay. During the 1980s, you were in the University of Miami, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Do you remember anything about the riots during that time?
Yes. There were two major riots. A riot is a riot, but there were two experiences. One was the first one was the Arthur McDuffie riot. If I remember, that was in May or June 17th, 1980. And this guy was on a motorcycle. He was an insurance man. And he was beaten to death by the, I think it was the City of Miami Police Department. Still for no reason. Other than the fact that he was black. And you look at the pictures of Arthur McDuffie's body when he was in the morgue. His face was twice his size. His body was beaten beyond recognition. And yet, he was the one that was charged with doing something wrong. I remember leaving the campus of UM and with three friends, another young man and two young ladies. We were going in the Metro Justice Building to protest like everybody else seemed to have been at that time. And cars, you know, if you know where 836 turns to where Jackson Memorial Hospital is, mm-hmm. there were cars who were stopped on that road, on that highway. You had to actually walk. You see, to get out of your car and walk because there was no more traffic. All the cars had covered the entirety of 836, and you had to walk down to the Metro Justice Building where the protest was started. And I remember someone had climbed up to where the American flag was and took it down and they burned it. Mm-hmm. And I saw people turning over police cars. And it was the first time in my life where I saw someone get killed right in front of me.
Wow.
There were people who were screaming and not knowing what to do, and it was chaotic. It was just people just expressing themselves in a very, very tough way. And I saw a man get stabbed by another man, and he was dead. I saw a woman get killed by a bunch of people that just trampled her, running to one place to the next, from one place to the next. And I recognized then that we had to get out of there. And I told my friend, let's go, we gotta go. Had the two young ladies with us, and we made it to the car somehow. But all the roads were being blocked by the police and the local members of the National Guard. And we wound up on this road where we thought was clear. We were just trying to make it back to the campus. And lo and behold, these National Guardsmen come out, and they have these M16 rifles. And they're running to the car with the rifles. I'm a passenger in the front seat. And I remember this very young, very scared National Guardsman pushing my head like this with the rifle. And there was another man, another officer, standing behind him, asking us, where were we going? And it's funny. I didn't anticipate your question, but that was an incredible experience for me, not just because of that, but because of what was also happening to me. It was my first real conversation with God. As I sat there in the car, and my friend, he's driving, the two young ladies, they were hysterical in the back seat, just screaming. It was so crazy and chaotic. And I said, God, I know you're not going to let me die like this right here. You know, I know I'm going to die one day, but you're not going to let me die like this right here. So I'm going to be cool about it, and I'm going to answer his questions. And he asked me, where are we going? And I just said, we're trying to make our way back to the University of Miami. We're college students, and we'd like to get back to the campus. And the guy kept pushing my head with the gun. And this other guy, who was a member of his group, came over to him and took the end of the gun, the rifle end of the gun, and pulled it down. And he said to me, do you have any ID? I said, yes, sir. He said, show it to me. You know what he's doing? He said, where is it? I said, it's in my pocket. He said, show it to me, very slow. I said, okay. He said, use one hand. And I remember reaching into my pocket like this, pulling out my wallet, with my hand up like that, and doing this, and then going in here and pulling out, you know, my ID and showing it to him like this. And when we did that, he turned to the young other guy. He says, they have to go through, they have to get back to school. And he says, we're going to help you. Talking to the man, because the guy was trembling. He was a young guy like me. He couldn't have been that much older than me if he was older than me. But he was doing what he was told to do. And that night, a lot of people died. One way or another. It was ugly, and it was just the beginning of days of that kind of behavior because people were angry. People felt like they were zeros in Miami. Miami was such an ugly place during that time. And it stayed that way for a very long time. And the remnants of such still exist today in Miami. You know, whenever people show the travel agencies or other beings pictures of Miami, they always talk about South Beach. It's beautiful over there. It's pretty. Very expensive and pretty. You can go over there and have a hell of a time. But that's just a little bit of the reality of Miami and of South Florida. We have a lot of work to do here. And it's going to take you guys again to step up and be a part of the solution.
Okay, so how did you get started with the I Have a Dream program?
Oh. I Have a Dream was an accident for me. I was writing the educational program for Dade County Schools and for what's called Citizens Crime Watch. And I had a rule about me and working. Until I got into an entrepreneurial activity, I was going to be working, and therefore my rule was I was going to work any place at all, no more than 6 years, and I was going to move on. 6 years was going to be my limit. And I was in my sixth year at Citizens Crime Watch. My good friend who knew that called me on my lunch break and said, man, I just saw the job for you. You need to go and call these people about this particular position. I called, not thinking very much of it, but I talked to a bunch of secretaries or whatever. Just so happens that the actual sponsor herself answered her phone and told her I was calling in reference to the ad that was in the personnel section of the paper. And she said she had so many resumes and applications already that it was closed. I said, okay, well, thank you. At least let me tell you what I think you should do with the position. You know, and I started telling her a whole bunch of stuff. Our conversation, which should have been about 5 minutes, turned into 50 minutes. And she finally said to me, can you come over to my house? And we can talk. I said, sure. Never thinking that, you know, I was going to be hired. But ultimately, I was. And thereby, the beginning of my relationship with I Have a Dream. We started in 1994 with the official launching of the program. 1995, we started with the kids in March when I came on board. March 15th, 1995. And now this is the 11th or 12th year. And those kids, of course, went through Dade County Public Schools, as you all are. And 97 kids of 97, 86 of those kids are in college somewhere around the state or around this country in vocational schools. One of them is in the military, who I saw to Killeen, Texas today. She's married with a beautiful little baby. And that's my experience that I have a dream.
Are there any requirements in order to be part of the program?
You just had to have been in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. And it had nothing to do with anything about your grades. Just had to be someplace at the right time. Those kids had no other requirement. And from that has come now nine other programs, eight other programs around Dade County, and hopefully there'll be more. But I tell you, I Have a Dream, and programs like it are very necessary because we recognize that, and you will recognize, that as you apply for college, if you are in need of financial aid, you're going to see that financial aid is going to be more and more of a challenge for you to get because the monies available for it are dwindling quicker and quicker every day. And so you have to really be about your own grades, that you can do the best you can, that you qualify for scholarships and other means of financial assistance, because it's getting harder and harder. Even when you want to go, my situation was I didn't really want to go. But even if you really want to go to college these days, it's going to be tougher and tougher for you not just to get into school, but to be able to pay to go there. It's extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate that it's that way. when you look at the realities of other countries that make college a non-expensive endeavor for young people, our country seems to think that college has to be for a certain group of people or a certain type of people, or really it should be open to all of us, financially and otherwise.
In your position, what is it exactly that you think?
Everything. I have to do a lot of counseling. I've had to do a lot of counseling, a lot of intervention when it becomes, it just always was that, you know, family intervention, meaning that you had to have home visits, two home visits on a regular basis, deal with parents, and the issues that you all create between you and your parents. I had to deal with all those things with my kids. It wasn't easy at all. One of the biggest challenges for me was as my kids got into high school, and I'll say my Turner Tech kids, because I had 17 kids here. You know, they probably knew a lot of stuff, you know. And they were smart. Yeah, they were real smart. And they were smarter than their parents, which put their parents at a disadvantage because they knew a lot of things, and their parents didn't know them necessarily. And so the parents felt like, you know, I'm going to show you, in some cases, that was to your parent. And these kids had to, they struggled with that because they didn't want to condescend necessarily to their parents to any great way. But those were issues like relationships, being out on your own, because they had some kids who lived on their own, had some kids in foster care, had some kids who had nobody, who were living on the street for real. You know, so it was a mixture of young people who went through, I have a dream in the public school experience, and have now moved on to other things. I'm so proud of them because it didn't have to happen the way it did, because all the odds were really against them. People told us that it would not work, and yet it did, and it had nothing to do with me. It was those kids saying, I'm going to make it happen for me. I'm so proud of them that they drive me to tears on a regular basis. Today I was crying before I came here when I saw one of, I should have brought the picture, when I saw one of my girls, Crystal, I forget her new name now because she's married, and she has a little baby girl, and the baby is gorgeous, my God, and she's very happy. She is very productive, living in Texas, and her husband's a great guy, had a great job. You know, life is going very well for them. And truthfully, I wish that for all young people, that you would have the chance to enjoy life, that you would do the things necessary that could assure you that your life will be fruitful and productive enough, that you can be not necessarily dependent, but independent, that you can make things happen for yourself when you want to, and not be held or bound to any situation that would relegate you to a particular lifestyle. That's so important. That's why this class is important, or this academy is important, because what happens here really is an introduction to another standard in life that other people who are your age don't get. So I hope you don't take this class for granted, nor your teacher. I'm not just saying this, you know, to blow smoke in her direction. It's not that, because she didn't ask me to say any of this. I hope that you take what you're doing here very seriously, that you get out of it all you can, that you exhaust her. She's already tired, I'm sure, with the craziness that goes on. But I'm saying with the other things, I'm talking about the important things, like asking her more questions about what you're doing, what you're trying to do. Pick her brain and ask her more and more, that you can find out more, that you can use more for yourselves.
Well, sir, since you grew up in the all-black section of Hollandale,
yes,
can you describe some of your family items?
Our biggest, and it was like going to Disney World, and there was no Disney World during that time, but our biggest family outing, to be honest with you all, was on a Friday night, going to get big castle burgers at Royal Castle. I'm serious, I'm not. When my father used to come home, I told you he came home late, and he would holler from the car, "All right, let's go, man. I don't care what was happening. My sister could be doing hair." That ever straightening comb in?
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. "My sister could be doing one month's hair, and it'd be halfway done. They didn't care. Put it down, let's go." and we'd run to the car. And my father would take us to Royal Castle. And you couldn't tell me that I was not on some incredible excursion with my family. We walked to Royal Castle, and I watched my daddy go in his pocket and pay for whatever. He said, "Get what you want." I was like, "Oh, my God. Get what I want. I need a milkshake, daddy. Get a milkshake." That was incredible. On top of the times that we would travel further, of course, we'd go, my grandmother and grandfather lived in Blakely, Georgia. And we periodically in the summer times go to Georgia. And I never did want to go. I didn't want to go because it was so far. And riding in a car was never a thrill of mine. I hated to go to Blakely. I remember getting there, and I loved my grandmother. She's deceased now. My grandfather is too. I remember embracing them and being happy to see them. At the same time, I'd be looking back at the car saying, "Okay, that was enough. I want to go back home now." After that long ride. On those type trips, you saw other representations of our society. And leaving Hallandale, Florida, and going into Blakely, Georgia, which was most certainly at least 10, 20 years behind what was happening here in Florida, was also scary. Because groups like the Ku Klux Klan, they were definitely around. I remember all the stories that my grandfather would tell about the Klan, and the number of times they'd come on the property, and he and my great-grandfather having to shoot at folks and shoot at the Klan, and I'm sure they probably killed a few of them too, because their lives were in danger. And how I lost some other relatives of my family who were hung.